Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the crossword compiler John Graham. Now aged 90, he works under the name Aracaria, and for more than 50 years has infuriated, intrigued and entertained a puzzle-hungry public with fiendish clues and mind-twisting anagrams. His interest in crosswords sprang from a rather cloistered childhood. His father was a clergyman, and growing up in a large family, entertainment was found inside the home and was of a rather old-fashioned variety. He's pretty dismissive of his time as a navigator in the RAF and of the weeks spent hiding behind enemy lines in Italy. After the war, he studied theology and, like his father, became a vicar. But when divorce forced him to leave the church, crosswords provided an unlikely source of revenue. He says, "The crossword is an art form which has no independent value apart from the esteem of the public." Is that the clue then, John Graham, that actually this is about an element of intellectual jousting with strangers? That's the pleasure of it, is it?
Yes, I think that's a pretty fair description. I hadn't thought of it myself, but yes, I think that's good. I hope that it also equips one for life in the sense that it makes one think more clearly and can only be good.
And also you've got to, presumably, because it is for so many people a rather ritualistic daily activity, you've got to leave people wanting to come back for more the next day as well.
Yes, though I don't know that one consciously does anything about that, but that's true, certainly, yes. So much of it, I think, is something that goes on unconsciously. You see the word, you play with it in your mind and you play with ideas related to it. You don't actually think about the punters at all at that stage. You try to do it for yourself, I think.
Right, but you do have devoted followers.
So I believe, yes. I can't quite think why.
Yes, and I'm wondering about cryptic crosswords, which for so many people are, you know, more than a closed book. They are impenetrable in their nature, and it seems to me they are quite a sort of, you know, a British pursuit, a little bit like cricket. You know, they require a lot of time, a lot of energy, and to outsiders they are essentially a pointless pursuit. Is that fair?
I think that's very fair, yes. People do occasionally even go to the lengths of framing these things. I've been sent them with the intention that I might keep them and hang them up on my walls, which is the last thing I want to do.
What about Sudoku? Do you consider that to be the devil's work?
Well, as I've never done one, it would be unfair to judge, but
I'm sure you do, yes, have a judgment. Share it with me.
Yes, I think that's fair comment. It takes people away from their proper occupation of solving cryptic crosswords. I think people's would be better employed doing my crosswords than doing the Sudoku.
Let's have some music then, John. We're going to begin with your first disc, and I want you to tell me why you've chosen it.
Well, I chose this piece because it's the first piece of serious music I ever got to know, and when I went to King's College, Cambridge, for my interview before going up, a group of us sat around with our prospective tutor, and he asked us each to choose a piece of music to play. And this was the only piece of serious music that I knew. I thought I'd better choose that. And so it's always been a favourite. Thank you.
That was the opening of the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Carl Böhm. So let's find out a little bit more then, John Graham, about cryptic crosswords. I mentioned a moment ago, to the uninitiated, to people like me, I'm afraid to say, they're a foreign language that you certainly haven't learned. I want to try to pick apart one of your clues that I was looking at. Now, the clue was, correcting sets in the north, oh, don't, I can't bear it. That was the clue. The answer was, you remember what it was. The answer was what?
Orthodontic.
Orthodontic. Now, you say that in a very matter-of-fact fashion, as if that's obvious to anybody with even half a brain. How do you begin with the clue and how do you reach orthodontic?
In the compiler's mind, the process is that you see the word, you think, this is an opportunity for a hidden clue. Sets nearly always, or very often, refers to teeth.
Right.
So orthodontic is correcting sets. That's the definition part of the clue. I can't remember exactly how the rest of it goes.
Correcting sets in the north, and there's a question
yes,
mark.
Yeah.
Oh, don't. I can't bear it.
The in very often refers to a hidden clue. So you have to go into this set of words to see
the answer.
So it's in the north, and then once you get to the after the end of north, the clue begins. Orth, I don't, I can't.
Indeed.
You can do it other ways, like saying part of or from or various ways of doing it, but in is the easiest.
You obviously, with that, you come up with the word, first of all, and then you have to cunningly work out a way of hiding it, obscuring
it. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
What about anagrams? I again, was caught by probably one of my favourite of yours. This was at a time when Geoffrey Archer was lying low. I don't even know if he was in the clink at this point. But anyway, the anagram that you made up was Chaste Lord Archer Vegetating.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. And you realised that these letters made up what?
They make the old vicarage, Grantchester, which is where he lives.
Indeed. That is an absolute corker. Did you celebrate the day you made up that one?
Well, I don't remember doing so particularly, but well, it was quite pleasing, I must say.
Quite pleasing. But that's the best we're going to get, yes.
I do it with Scrabble letters, with a big one like that.
Right, you use Scrabble tiles?
Yes.
You don't do it on a computer?
No, I wouldn't know how to do it on a computer.
Right.
I just get all the tiles out, making quite sure that I don't lose anything, because it's so easy to make mistakes with anagrams otherwise.
What about, you said checking, and presumably you have people who check your
puzzles. Yes, I do indeed.
How does that work? Explain that to me.
Well, I send the puzzles to them. They try solving the puzzles. They have the answers ready, and so they can check. And they come back to me and let me know where they think I've gone wrong, but also they check all the references I make.
Right. Do they ever tell you, John, it's impossible? You'll drive people to, you know, an institution with this puzzle.
The worst I get is very hard. That's a polite way of saying the same thing, though.
Yes. Right. So we're going to go to disc number two, then. Tell me what's coming next and why you've chosen it, John.
I love Kerosene Ferry the first time I heard her sing. But it's not just that. Where I live now, I have great friends, a family who have more or less adopted me, so to speak, since I was widowed. But the lady of the family who died last year, she was a contralto, and concerto singers always remind me of her. And this is in her memory, really.
That was Kathleen Ferrier and Blow the Wind Southerly. So let's go back, John Graham. You were born in 1921, the very difficult years after the war for most people. What are your earliest memories?
They don't go back very early. I hardly remember anything, clearly, until I was about six. Then I just remember bits of the countryside where we lived in Wiltshire.
Describe your home to me. What was it like?
Well, it was a big country vicarage. We didn't have an electric light at that stage, and we didn't have any gas, of course, or anything like that. We had oil lamps, so it was By these standards, primitive, I imagine. It was quite normal then.
Yes. Your grandfather and your father had both gone into the church.
Yes.
And what sort of man was your father? What was he like?
He was a lovely man, and he was a very private man, I think. I never felt I got to know him very well in some ways, but I've always loved him very dearly. And I also felt for a long time that he was rather fragile and I needed to look after him. This is probably quite untrue, but...
Did you feel that as a young boy?
I wasn't conscious of it, but I think we were brought up to feel that. I think my mother had felt that and brought us up, I think, to feel the same. He was shy. That's certain, he was shy.
And had he fought in the war?
He'd been a chaplain in the war.
Right.
He would never speak about that at all.
Right. Very generational, though. I mean,
yes,
for people,
indeed,
yes.
That's normal. Yeah.
Tell me about your mother.
She was amazing, really. Very forceful. We were six altogether. I'm the eldest. I think she could get things wildly wrong sometimes, but most of the time she was wonderful.
And I mentioned that as a family, and I suppose back in the 1920s and 30s this wouldn't have been quite so unusual, but even by those standards it sounds relatively old-fashioned and self-contained to me. You were encouraged to make your own entertainment. The family unit was where you pretty much stayed. And
yes, it was. Yes.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I think it's because we were a big family to a great extent, but living in the country, you weren't encouraged to mix with the village children, you know, because they were just riff-raff, I think. It was never put like that, but that's how it really was, I think. There were just a few families around the place who were gentry and you were allowed to associate with. We hardly ever did, mind you. But this is, for me, very weird because, well, it was almost ashamed to admit it was like that, but that's how it was.
And so what did you get up to at home? Did you begin... I mean, were you a boy who liked puzzles?
I think we all did in the family, probably, yes. The Times crossword was part of my parents' life.
And did you start to make up crosswords when you were little?
Yes, but I couldn't tell you at what age. We did do it fairly early. When my younger brother was old enough to take an interest in it, we really got into it then, I think.
When you look back, I mean, it sounds like quite a sort of quaint childhood. When you look back at it now, does it seem like more than 80 years ago that you lived that life?
Yeah, it does. In fact, I can't really believe any of it. I don't think I live in the past at all, really.
How interesting. Are you nostalgic for the past?
No. I do like to go back, but it's not nostalgia, I don't think. I mean, my heart's not in it, it's curiosity, I think, but it wouldn't matter if I didn't do it.
For now, John, tell me about your next piece of music. We're on the third piece now.
Ah, yes, the Peasant Cantata. It's the first time I remember doing any choral singing. And although I'm by no means a singer of any kind, but I do love choral singing and I love singing a part. We sang it at school. I don't remember exactly when. I must say, I don't think I've ever heard it since. So it's just a childhood memory.
That was the ending of Bach's Peasant Cantata with Lynn Dawson and Stephen Alder and the Friends of Apollo. So, John Graham, you were the oldest of six children, and your father went on to become a bishop, and he was the principal of a theological college, and his father before him, as we know, had risen high up in the church. Were you expected to follow in that path?
No, not to rise high, no, I don't think so. I don't remember ever discussing it, actually. I do remember that when I finally made up my mind after a good deal of coming and going mentally, I did want to do this, he seemed quite pleased.
Tell me about the year of coming and going then.
Well, I lost my faith, as they say, in the course of the war. Not because of the war particularly, but it just didn't seem to make sense at the time. I didn't actually seriously consider being ordained as a clergyman, but eventually I decided that's what I should do.
And prior to that, then, you say during the war, you had left Cambridge, you joined the RAF, and tell me about the time that your plane caught fire, did it?
Yes. It seems to be in a flare at the back that's ignited. Nobody knows why. And the plane caught fire. All I knew about it, sitting in the front, because I was a navigator, and I couldn't, of course, see what was going on in the back. It was just a shriek from the back saying the kite's on fire. And that's the last I heard, because the intercom was then burnt out. The next thing I heard was the pilot ringing the bell, which is, get out. So I got out.
Yes, you bailed out over Italy.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was night. Night intruding was our job. They called it night intruding, dropping small bombs on railway lines and that kind of stuff. So we were quite low level, so it wasn't very far to go. So it was rather urgent to get your parachute open fairly quickly.
Right. And there had been four men on board your plane.
Yes.
How many survived?
Just me and the pilot. The pilot flew the plane back. As I bailed out, I watched this blazing object going away in the sky. Quite amazing. He did. It was a magnificent piece of flying, it really was. When I got down, I according to instructions, I hid the parachute as best I could and went to the nearest house and knocked on the door. And they said, go down the road. I went down the road to another house where I was taken in and looked after.
And there, for an amount of time, in fact, that they took you into their house, this Italian family, and looked after you, where were you in the house? Presumably you had to be hidden.
I was in the stable to begin with, which is very nice and warm, full of rats. But they moved me
full
out.
Full of rats?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, yeah. But, I mean, you would get that in a stable, so it's all right.
Right.
Then they moved me out after a couple of days. I thought that was too dangerous. They moved me out to a little hide that they had in the field for shooting birds from.
And how much communication was there? I mean, on the one hand, of course, they clearly wanted to shield you, but on the other hand, they themselves must have felt a degree of terror at doing that.
Well, they were a bit scared. They were. The village school teacher was billeted on them. So she actually gave me lessons in Italian. I gave her lessons in, I think, in English, but also in Latin, I think. It worked out very well. And I was there for 51 days, and I was rescued and brought back to behind our lines and went back to the squadron. Then I knew all about it then.
And how were you rescued?
There was a little group of people who had escaped from the prison of war camps, and they had contact with the partisans, and the partisans arranged for a motorboat to come and drop arms for them and pick us up. So a group of five of us went back on the boat.
Your parents surely must have thought you were dead.
Well, they were told I was missing. Yes. That's all they were told.
You were mentioned in dispatches then. Do you?
That's because I bailed out and got safely back. It was quite automatic. Anybody who did that was mentioned in dispatches.
You don't want to take any credit for that at all. I mean, it seems to have been a rather brave and extraordinary thing that you did.
Well, you just... You did what you did, didn't you, then? I mean, it wasn't bravery particularly. We just did it.
And
I was probably scared stiff at the time.
Yes. And you said that losing your faith, you don't think, had anything particularly to do with the war. But I'm wondering about the random nature of the fact that four men go up in a plane, two of them make it, two of them do not. Did that not in any way sort of cause you to question the meaning of life and the purposefulness of a god?
I don't think so, really. I don't think that made any difference. I mean, all those questions occurred. Of course they do, and they always do and they always will. But I don't think that actually that had much to do with it, because in a war you just do all this stuff and you don't really think that much about it. It sort of happens and that's it.
OK, let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear next, John?
Count John McCormack and the Star of the County Down. Well, this is the very early days. Somebody must have given us a gramophone, one of these enormous great things with one of those funny horns on the top and steel needles. We had just a few records and this was one of them. I'm not sure I like it so much now, but I loved it then.
Banbridge town in the county down one morning last July. Down a boring green came a sweet colleen, and she smiled as she passed me by. She looked so sweet from her two bare feet to the sheen of her nut-brown hair. Such a coaxing elf, I was ashamed of myself, for to see I was really there.
That was John McCormack and Star of County Down. I should tell our listeners, John Graham, that you got a fit of what I can only describe as the giggles during that track. Why did you get the
well,
giggles?
Well, I was thinking I would never now choose that as a record. I put it in because of the history of it.
Yes.
I wouldn't particularly want to play it again.
Well, maybe for the last time there, you heard it today. Yeah. So you returned to Cambridge after the war.
Yes.
You'd been studying, what were you studying at Cambridge?
I did classics for the first 2 years at Cambridge.
You didn't pick up your studies in classics?
No, I decided to read theology because, not because at that stage I wanted to go into church, but because it was the only thing I could, well, I tried mathematics first. I read mathematics at Cambridge for 48 hours, but I went to four lectures and didn't understand the words of any of them. So I thought I'd better switch. And theology was easier because I have a fairly good knowledge of the Bible and that sort of thing from the background, so it was easier to do.
So it wasn't a calling?
It wasn't a calling at that stage, no.
What appealed to you at that stage then? It was just that you could do it?
Yes, just that I could do it at that stage, yes.
Right, so when did the calling come?
About two-thirds of the way through the course, really.
Can you describe it to me? What happened?
I can't really. It just, I was saying my prayers and just somehow I knew. It's the only time it's ever happened to me, I may say. But it did seem as I was just being spoken to. You've got to do this. You know, your country needs you and all that sort of thing.
But it wasn't a straightforward career because, tell me, early on, you were sent away. You went to your first parish, which
went to the first parish in St John's East Dulwich, South London.
And what happened?
I fell in love with a girl in the parish, and it was not a tradition of the parish that anybody should do that. We were not supposed to have anything to do with all that sort of thing. We were supposed to be celibates.
But this was not a rule of the church.
It wasn't a rule of the church. It was a rule of that particular parish, and quite a lot of parishes there were like that.
Right, so it was a very high church.
It was a high church, yes.
Right.
Yes.
So what happened? You were...
They found me another job a long way away.
Right. What did you think about that?
She said, well, didn't question it, really. I knew the rules when I got there, and if you break the rules, you suffer, you know.
And what happened with your sweetheart? Did you keep writing or keep...?
Yeah, we kept in touch. She actually had TB and spent the year in a sanatorium while I was up in Durham. Then finally she was better, and finally we got married and went to a new job in Aldershot.
And when you were sent away to Durham...
Yeah.
Your father by that point must have been... Was he a bishop at that point?
It must have been, mustn't he?
Yes. I'm not suggesting it was a scandal. But
no, it wasn't anything like
no,
that.
No, he...
It wasn't. No, that came later.
Good. I look forward to that. But at the time that you were sent away and your father was a bishop, was he disappointed? Was there a sense that you'd got it wrong, you'd breached the rules?
I don't think so. I never felt he was being judgmental about it at all.
And so you did get married?
I did get married.
Yes. And your marriage lasted a good...
26 years?
26 years. Then the marriage ended.
Yes.
That was not just the end of your relationship. It then subsequently became the end of your career. Tell me what happened.
Well, yes. In those days, you couldn't be divorced and continue in the ministry of the church.
Yes.
It was clear enough. And the rules, again, were quite clear. And it was beginning to be quite clear to me that I couldn't do it, actually. Couldn't stay. That I must go. So I went.
And given that you lost your career... Your marriage broke down. I'm imagining you must have lost your home at the same time.
Yes,
that would have been tied to the church.
Yes.
I mean, those are three great blows to take at once. Was it a particularly gloomy time?
A lot of that period, I suppose, because it was a lot of it was very traumatic. I suppose one does been allowed to forget it somehow.
Right.
I think actually life was so difficult before that. I think it wasn't so much the blow. I think it was released probably, and I was very lucky. Anyway, materially, because Margaret had a house. Her husband had died very suddenly, so I had somewhere to go, but I needed more money.
And so Margaret, just to be clear, went on to become your second wife.
Yes, yes.
More about Margaret and your life with her in a moment. For now, though, John Graham, let's have some more music. We're at disc number 5.
Well, this is from the 60s, you see, at the time of all this was going on. I had 10 years at Reading University as chaplain, when everything was changing, the era of the Beatles and everything, and I did wonder what I'd like to choose best from that era. So I came out with this one because it's the flip side of Where to Show the Pale, which everybody knows, and this is not so well known, and I think it's better.
Your trouser cuffs are dirty and your shoes are laced up wrong. You'd better take off your homework, cause your overcoat is too long.
That was Procol Harum and Homburg. So, John Graham, you said a moment ago you had to think of a way of getting some money. This was the end of your career and the end of your first marriage, and so you thought what?
Well, I thought the only thing I can do is crossword puzzles, and so I wrote to my boss at The Guardian, John Perkins, the crossword editor, as he then was, and asked if he could find me any more work.
So up until that point, had you been doing sporadic?
I've been doing it regularly for some years.
But you say you'd regularly been contributing, but it'd been a paid hobby.
Yes, that's right, paid hobby, absolutely, yes.
And you say it was traumatic, and a moment ago you said there was a sort of sense of release. Where was, you know, having left the church and been free of a marriage that hadn't ended happily, what was the trauma? Was it having failed? Was it feeling that you didn't make the grade?
I suppose it's partly that. I mean, it's just, I think an unhappy marriage is such a major disaster anyway to anybody, but it's worse for a vicar because everything you'll do all the time is supposed to be upholding the sanctity of marriage, happy relationships in the family and all that stuff, which you can't do.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, it's a major problem and I think it's a major headache, I think.
Tell me about marrying Margaret then. When were you able to get married?
It was 7 years after we first lived together, and we were together for another 7 years. It took time to get the divorce sorted out and everything, and we were happy living together anyway. And it didn't make much difference to me then whether I married or not, to be honest. It didn't seem to matter. The rules were broken anyway, so...
And so why did you decide to get married?
It seemed to make sense on the whole. We knew we wanted to stay together, and marriage was what you did, you stayed together, so we did it.
And what about, where did your faith sit in all of this? Because I'm imagining it must have been sorely tested.
I don't think I ever really questioned it. I probably questioned it, but I don't think I ever came to any different answer. I think it's always been there.
And when you look these days at the way that the church chooses to deal, or indeed at times not deal, with issues like women vicars or accepting gay clergy, what are your thoughts?
I think the church as an organisation is not very good at dealing with stuff. We just don't do it very well. Most things we do is a bit of a muddle. But I think that's probably inevitable.
Let's have some more music then. John, tell us what we're going to hear next. We're on disc six.
Oh, yes. Well, when I went up to King's, a lot of my people I knew best were called scholars. So it was very much an important part of life. And I think that the carols I've chosen, which is quite often done at the carol service on Christmas Eve, is, for me, the highlight of what they do.
From Persian lands of light to Jordan follow the pointing stars, and this the quest of the tapestry.
That was Stephen Varco and the choir of King's College, Cambridge, and Three Kings from Persian Lands. You have, John Graham, just to be clear, been described in the past as the Tiger Woods of the crossword world, in the days when that was still a compliment. You're considered to be at the very, very top of your game. Is there quite a distinct hierarchy?
No, certainly not. And I think these things are very much a question of personal taste. I mean, I don't suppose everybody would agree with this assessment at all.
One of the things I'm wondering is, how do you maintain the current status of your work, to know that you are in touch with the words that everybody is using, and to know that you're sort of out there, if you like, absorbing all the same things that everybody else is absorbing, in order to set clues that seem to chime with the lives we live?
Well, this is always a problem, I think. And I have made sure that one of my checkers is at least a lot younger than me. Well, both of them are, but...
Well, how old are your checkers?
Well, I have a checker who's been a very long time, is now over 70.
Right.
So I've got a new checker who's over 40. I should really get another one who's 20, but I haven't managed that yet. I keep my friendships young, I suppose. I associate quite a lot with people who are a lot, you know, well, everybody I associate with is younger than me, but but yes, I mean, I try and keep in touch that way. But,
yeah, yeah, it's quite easy when you're 90 to make sure that everybody
yes,
else is
younger. Yes, it's not difficult.
And when you celebrated your 90th birthday, which was recently, a group of compilers did explain to me what they did as a gift for you.
Some of my fellow compilers got together and did two crosswords for me, actually, one for the Financial Times and one for The Guardian. And they gave them to me for my birthday. I have both copies framed.
How quickly did you complete them?
I don't think I could finish one of them. I think one of them was too difficult. I'm not a particularly good solver. I can do some eventually, but not often can I do them very quickly.
Let's have some more music then. Tell me what we're going to hear next.
Well, this is a song of Mary. It's a translation of the Magnificat written by my sister, Mary Holtby, who is always the person in my family who I've been closest to. I mean, closest to all of them, but especially to Mary. She and Richard Shepherd actually write quite a lot of stuff together. She writes the words and he writes the music, and I think it's really good.
That was the Song of Mary with the Church Choir of St Andrews in West Tarring. The organist was Christopher Harris, and they were directed by John Wardle. The music was written by Richard Shepherd, and the words were by your sister, Mary Holtby. So, John Graham, your second wife died a few years ago now, tell me.
Yes, that. Yes, 16 years ago now.
Oh, 16 years ago. Yes. So
17 years ago, sorry. it creeps up on one, doesn't it?
And you said earlier there was a family in the village who
yes.
was as good as adopted you. So you don't have children of your own. Do you see...
I have stepchildren of my own, but yes. Margaret had children. Yes, I see them.
I'm wondering, in this world where we can be entertained constantly by our Nintendo Game Boys and mobile phones and obviously constantly the television and however many hundred channels we want to tap into, if you ever worry that the crossword is going to be a dying art...
It does cross one's mind, but perhaps rather selfishly, I think it'll probably see me out. I mean, it's the same thing with books, isn't it? One doesn't know what's going to happen, but for the moment, things are okay, and I think it'll still be all right.
And what about, do you have, of all the thousands of puzzles that you've compiled, must be thousands, mustn't it?
Must be thousands, yeah. Yes.
Do you have a favourite clue? Is there something that has really given you a huge amount of satisfaction?
Well, I particularly like, though it's not often picked up by other people, is the clue for general election, which is going to the country, let green line coach drop companion off, which is an anagram of let green line coach and then take off the CH at the end, which is the companion.
John, you're going to have to bear with me now. I need more explanation than you've just given me. Take me through that again, more slowly.
Okay, right. Going to the country is, as you know, the synonym for an election. It's also, if you're living in London, you go to the country, you take a green line bus, so green line coach. So let green line coach, without the CH at the end, those 15 letters of let green line, COA,
yes.
are the anagram for general election. And drop companion off means you take the CH, the companion, at the end. And it makes such nice sense that I was very pleased with that one.
Yes, it's pretty good, I have to say. Now that I do understand it, it's pretty good. We are constantly told that for those of us who try to do crosswords, it'll keep us agile, it'll keep us young. What impact do you think it has on you actually setting the crosswords?
Well, I suppose it's kept me young. Something has.
Let's have your final piece of music then, John Graham. What are we going to hear this morning?
This is the Heavens Are Telling from Haydn's Creation. This is my favourite piece of, if you like, classical religious music. I've always loved it, and it expresses my faith very well. I mean, it was the basis of it, I think. It was done by the St Ives Choral Society a few years back, and so that's a special memory for me.
That was the Berlin Radio Symphony Choir and Orchestra, conducted by Helmut Koch, and The Heavens Are Telling from Haydn's Creation. So, John, I'm going to give you the books now. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. Your book is going to be what?
Going to be The Short Stories of Psyche.
Ah, right. You may have that. And a luxury, too, you're allowed.
My first choice would have been The Madonna and Child from Michelangelo from the Church of Our Lady in Bruges, but as I can't take that away from Bruges, because I couldn't live with my conscience if I did, I would like a telescope.
Ah.
So that I can see the heavens telling the glory of God. And I've never had one.
Right. Easily I can give you that. And if you had to choose just one of the eight discs that we've heard today,
I would choose
save,
the last one, The Heavens Are Telling.
Choose the Haydn.
Yes,
right.
I would.
It's yours. The Reverend John Graham, Arocaria, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.